ordered by Majid to perform harassing operations against the population in a manner that would not put his cell into too much jeopardy. He long assumed he was being kept safe and in place for a major operation. And when Majid called him on his voice-over internet line 3 days prior, it had been the proudest moment of Abdul Ibrahim's life. Following orders received in the phone call, Abdul Ibrahim had picked his 5 best operators, and they all met at their safe house in Mysore. Ibrahim appointed one of the men his successor as chief of operations. The young man was shocked to be told he would be in charge of Lashkar-e-Taiba ops in southern India in 2 days' time. The other 4 men felt lucky to be told they would be going with Abdul on a martyrdom operation in Bangalore. They took the best weapons from the cache. 4 grenades, 10 homemade pipe bombs, and a pistol and rifle for each of the 5 men. This, along with nearly 2,000 rounds of combined ammunition, they packed into backpacks and suitcases along with a change of clothing. Within hours, they were on a train to the northeast, and they arrived in Bangalore early in the morning of their second-to-last day. A local man with Pakistani roots met them, took them to his home, and handed them the keys to 3 motorcycles. Riaz Rehan himself had picked the target. Bangalore is often referred to as the Silicon Valley of India. With a population of 6 million, it possesses many of the largest technology companies in the huge nation, many located in Electronics City, a 330-acre industrial park in the western suburbs of Bangalore, more precisely, in Dota Tagur and Agrahara, former villages that had been swallowed up with the explosion of both population and progress here. Rehan felt that Abdul Ibrahim and his 4 men would be slaughtered relatively quickly if they attacked this target. Electronics City had good security for a non-governmental installation. But still, any success at all by Abdul Ibrahim and his men would send a symbolic message. Electronics City was a major outsourcing hub of India, and the operations run from offices there involved hundreds of companies, large and small, around the world. Blowing up people and property here would affect, to one degree or another, many of the Fortune 500 companies, and this would ensure that the attack would have a huge amount of play in the Western media. Rehan reasoned that a single death here by the Southern India cell of LET would carry the value of 20 deaths of peasants in a Kashmiri village. He intended for Abdul Ibrahim's act in Bangalore to create a thunderclap of terror that would reverberate across the globe and frighten the West, ensuring that India would not be able to downplay such an attack. More attacks would follow, and with each attack, the conflict between India and Pakistan would worsen. Riaz Rehan understood all this because he was a westernized jihadist, an army general, and an intelligence chief. All these titles attributed to just one man gave him another, more ominous identity. Riaz Rehan, aka Majid, was, above all, a master terrorist. When Abdul Ibrahim and his 4 men arrived in Bangalore and fueled up their motorbikes, they immediately began reconnaissance on their target, because they had no time to waste. They found that the industrial park was covered with heavily armed security, both private guards and police. Further, the Central Industrial Security Force, the Indian paramilitary force in charge of government industrial installations, airports, and nuclear site security, was now working under contract for certain well-heeled private businesses in Electronics City. The CISF had even established checkpoints at the entrance to the industrial park. Ibrahim was certain he and his men would not be able to breach any of the major buildings themselves. He was dejected. But nevertheless, he decided to spend much of the time until the attack driving around the perimeter of Electronics City, searching for a way in. He did not find a way in, but on the final morning, just hours before his planned attack, he decided to pass by his target one last time in daylight. He traveled alone on his motorcycle along the Hosur main road, took the huge modern Bangalore elevated tollway, a 10-kilometer flyover that ran between Madawala and Electronics City, and he immediately found himself surrounded by dozens of buses packed with workers heading to their jobs from Bangalore proper. Instantly, he saw his mission before him. Abdul Ibrahim returned to the safe house in the city and told his men that the plans had changed. They did not attack that night as he'd promised Majid. He knew his handler would be furious with him for disobeying a direct order, but he obeyed his other order and made no contact with his handler, nor any other LET asset. Instead, he destroyed his mobile phone, prayed, and went to sleep. He and his men awoke at 6 a.m. They prayed again, drank tea in silence, and then climbed aboard the 3 motorcycles. They arrived at the flyover at 8 a.m. Abdul rode his own bike 200 meters behind the second motorcycle, which itself was 200 meters behind the first. He carried the pipe bombs and grenades in his backpack slung on his chest to where he could reach into the bag and pull them out while he drove. The first bike pulled alongside an articulated bus with 50 passengers inside. As the driver of the motorcycle advanced slowly along the long, two-sectioned vehicle, the rider pulled an AK-47 from a bag in his lap, its wire stock folded to shorten its length. The gunman calmly and carefully lined his sights up on the side of the bus driver's head, and he pressed the trigger. With a short pop and a burst of gray smoke, the bus driver's window shattered and the man tumbled out of his seat, and the huge bus careened sharply to the right and then jackknifed. It hit several other cars as it skidded at speed, then it slammed into the concrete wall of the flyover, striking more cars that had pulled quickly off the road in an attempt to get out of the way. Some in the bus died in the crash, but most were merely wounded after having been thrown from their seats. The first motorcycle moved on, leaving the wounded bus behind as it continued up the road, attacking more vehicles in its path. But the second motorcycle, also carrying a driver and a gunman, passed by the crash 30 seconds later. The rear rider's AK barked, and his 75-round drum spun, releasing its supersonic bullets through the barrel. The rounds tore into the bus and into the wounded, killing the men and women as they tried in vain to scramble free of the wreckage, and killing those in other vehicles who had pulled over to help. This second bike, too, rolled on, leaving the carnage behind as the rear gunner reloaded and prepared to attack the next scene of horror up the flyover. But Abdul Ibrahim arrived at the articulated bus and the wreckage around it just moments later. He pulled up in the middle of the slaughter just like dozens of other cars, vans, and motorcycles had done. The thin Lashkar-e-Taiba operative took a pipe bomb from his satchel, lit it with a lighter, and rolled it under a small Volkswagen bus that was parked in the jam, and then he drove away quickly. Seconds later, the VW exploded. The hot metal and shattered glass tore through the traffic jam, and fire ignited leaking gas from the articulated bus. Men and women burned alive across the two southbound lanes of the flyover as the Lashkar cell continued on, a rolling three-stage attack along the raised toll road. They continued on like this for several kilometers. The first two bikes poured automatic weapons fire into moving buses. The vehicles stopped suddenly, careened left or right. Many crashed into cars and trucks. Ibrahim cruised slowly and calmly through the wreckage left behind by his comrades, pulled to a stop next to one bus after another, smiled grimly at the screams and moans from inside the wreckage, and tossed in grenades and pipe bombs. 24-year-old Kiron Yadaya was driving himself to work that morning because he had missed his carpool. A Jawan, enlisted soldier with the Central Industrial Security Force, he worked the day shift as a patrolling constable at Electronics City, an easy job after 2 years of service deployed in a paramilitary unit. Normally, he packed into a van with six of his mates at a bus stop in front of the Meenakshi Temple for the ride across town to work. But today, he was running late and, consequently, traveling alone. He had just paid his toll to get on the flyover, and he pushed the accelerator on his tiny two-seater Tata nearly down to the floorboard to climb the ramp to the restricted access road that traveled to Electronics City. As he drove, he listened to a CD in his stereo. The riffs of Bombay Basement were jacked up full volume, and he rapped along with the MC at the top of his lungs. The track ended as Kiron merged into the thick traffic, and the next song had just begun, a thumping electronic reggae-infused dance beat. When the young man heard a low whump-whump that seemed to defy the rhythm, he looked at his stereo. But when he heard it again, louder than the music coming through his speakers, he looked into his rearview mirror, and he saw black smoke rising from a dozen sources on the flyover behind him. The nearest plume was just 100 yards back, and he saw a flaming minibus in the far right-hand lane. Constable Yadaya saw the motorcycle a moment later. Just 40 meters away, two men rode a yellow Suzuki. The rear rider held a Kalashnikov, and he fired it from the hip at a four-door sedan that then sideswiped a bus as it swerved to escape the hot lead. Yadaya could not believe the images in his rearview mirror. The motorcycle streaked closer and closer to his tiny car, but Constable Yadaya just kept driving, as if he were watching an action show on television. The Suzuki bike passed by his car. The rider was hooking a fresh mag into his AK, and he even made eye contact with Yadaya in his tiny two-seater, before the pair of terrorists wove in front of other cars and out of view. The CISF Jawan heard more shooting behind him now, and finally he reacted to the action. The Tata pulled off the road on the left, just ahead of another car that had done the same. Yadaya climbed out, then reached back in, grabbing his work bag. After unzipping the bag, he reached in. His fingers felt past his plastic lunch container and his sweater, and they wrapped around the Heckler & Koch MP5 submachine gun that he carried while on duty. He grabbed his weapon as close rifle fire and incessant honking of horns assaulted his ears. With the gun and his single reserve magazine of 30 rounds of ammo, Yedaya sprinted into traffic, searching for a target. Men on motorcycles and men and women in private cars raced by. Everyone on the flyover knew they were under assault, but there was nowhere to turn off until the next off-ramp more than a kilometer farther on. Vehicles hit one another as they fought to get out of the way of the slaughter, and Yedaya, operating on one part training to three parts adrenaline, just ran out into the midst of all this madness. 50 meters back, he saw a yellow Mazda SUV slam hard into the waist-high protective barrier on the edge of the road. It hit with such speed that it then flipped over the side and spun through the air, almost as if in slow motion, before it hurtled some 40 feet down toward the heavy traffic on the service road below the flyover. A motorcycle approached Yedaya. It was nearly identical to the one that had passed him a minute before, and the man behind the driver held a rifle with a large drum magazine. The driver saw the uniformed CISF constable with the black subgun standing in the traffic, but he could not warn his gunner. So as Yedaya raised his MP5 to fire, the biker slid his Suzuki onto the ground. He rolled off of it and then slid with his partner. Yedaya raised his ring sight over the man with the Kalashnikov, and he fired. Now his training in the paramilitaries was put to good use. His shots tore up the road, and then the man. Blood fountained from the terrorist's salwar kameez. The man in the street dropped his AK and then stilled, and Yedaya moved his sights to the driver. The CISF warned their jawans that Pakistani terrorists, as this man certainly was, often wore suicide vests that they would detonate if they faced capture, and the CISF therefore instructed their men to offer no quarter to a terrorist operative when caught in the act. Young Kiron Yedaya did not weigh the pros and cons of shooting an unarmed man. As long as the Islamist lived on this earth, he was a danger to India, the country the constable had sworn to protect to his dying breath. Kiron Yedaya emptied his weapon into the man lying in the street. As he reloaded his MP5, he turned to begin running after the other bike, but he heard the detonation of a hand grenade in the heavy traffic behind him. He knew instantly there was a third motorcycle still behind him. It would be approaching in moments, and it was up to him to stop the attack. Abdul Ibrahim fired his Makarov pistol into the chest of the driver of a passenger van. The driver slumped to the floor, his foot came off the brake, and this caused the big vehicle to rear-end a Fiat with a dead husband and wife in the front seat. In the back three rows of the van, 8 Europeans in business suits recovered from the crash, and then cowered at the sight of the terrorist climbing off his bike, and then, with an incredible expression of peace on his face, pulling a pipe bomb out of a bag hanging from his chest. Ibrahim looked down to his lighter, careful to put the flame on the tip of the short wick of his bomb, lest he martyr himself accidentally. He lit his wick, replaced the lighter in his pocket, and then reached back to toss the bomb under the van. Just then, he heard the rat-a-tat of a submachine gun firing up the street. He turned to look at the source of the fire. He knew his men carried heavier rifles. He saw the Indian CISF man, saw the flash of fire from his weapon, and then felt his body buckle in spasm with the impact of the bullets. He was hit twice in the pelvis and groin, and he fell to the ground, on top of his improvised explosive device. Abdul Ibrahim shrieked, "Allahu Akbar!" just before his pipe bomb detonated into his chest, blowing him to bits. Constable Kiron Yedaya came upon the bullet-riddled bodies of the final two men in the terror cell a few minutes later. The pair had tried to run their Suzuki motorcycle through a hasty CISF roadblock just before the last off-ramp before Electronics City. The 8 constables stood over the dead men, but Yedaya screamed at them. He told them to stop admiring their handiwork, and to help him tend to the 2 dozen or so scenes of bloodshed all the way down the southbound lane of the 10-kilometer stretch of the Bangalore elevated tollway. Together these men, followed soon by hundreds of other first responders, spent the entire day treating survivors of the massacre. Riaz Rehan was in his office at ISI headquarters in the Abhpara district of Islamabad when his television reported a huge traffic accident in Bangalore. It meant nothing to him at first, but when the size of the carnage was relayed by the news anchor, Rehan stopped his other work and sat in rapt attention at his desk, watching the television. Within minutes, there was confirmation that there had been a gun battle, and within minutes more, terrorists were being blamed for a massacre. Rian had awoken furious with the LET cell for not executing the night before, but now he was ecstatic. He could not believe these reports out of Bangalore. He had hoped for a casualty count of 20 with at least 10 dead, perhaps some news footage of a burning guard post or a crater next to a building. Instead, his five-man-strong cell, with only 5 rifles and a few small explosives, had managed to massacre 61 people and injure an incredible 144. Rian beamed with pride and made a mental note that when he became president of Pakistan, he would have a statue built in honor of Abdul Ibrahim. But he also realized the attack had actually done more damage than he wanted. LET would be targeted with renewed vigor by not only the Indians, but also the Americans. The pressure on Pakistan's government to root out LET would be twice what he'd expected. Rian knew that the U.S.-Pakistani Intelligence Fusion Center would be working overtime now and shifting their workload toward LET. Rian did not panic. Instead, he reached out to his LET contacts and told them he would take over as project manager for the next operation, and it would need to be moved up on the calendar. Forces opposed to LET and his government, forces who are allied with the United States, would begin rounding up the usual suspects after this attack, and Rian knew that every day before phase 2 of his plan to bring Pakistan and India to the brink of war would increase the chance that Operation Saker would be somehow compromised. 32. Valentin Kovalenko was nothing like his father. Where Oleg had been big and fat, 35-year-old Valentin looked like a gym rat. He was thin but muscular. He wore a beautiful tailored suit that Laska had no doubt cost more than the car Oleg drove back in Moscow. Laska knew enough about luxury items to recognize that Valentin's fashionable Moss-Lipau eyeglasses cost more than $3,000. Another stark departure from the demeanor of his father, especially the version of his father that Laska remembered from Prague, was that Valentin seemed quite friendly. Upon his arrival in Laska's suite just after 10 p.m., he'd complimented the Czech on his tireless philanthropy and support for the causes of the downtrodden. Then he'd taken a chair by the fireplace after politely turning down the offer of a snifter of brandy. When both men were settled in front of the fire, Valentin said, "My father says he knows you from your days in Prague. That is all he has said, and I have made it a point to not ask him for any more information than that." His English was spoken with a noticeable British accent. Laska shrugged. Valentin was being polite, and it might even be true, but if Laska's plan was to go forward, there was not a chance in the world that Valentin Kovalenko would not look into the past of the famous Czech. And there was no chance he would not find out about Laska's duties as a mole. There was no point in hiding it. "I worked for your father. Whether or not you know that yet, you will soon enough. I was an informant, and your father was my handler." Valentin smiled a little. "My father impresses me sometimes. 10,000 bottles of vodka down the hatch and the old man still can keep secrets. That is bloody impressive." "He can," agreed Laska. "He did not tell me anything about you. My other sources in the East via my Progressive Nations Institute were the ones who told me about your position in SVR. Valentin nodded. "In my father's day, we'd send men and women to the gulag for revealing that information. Now I will just send an email to Internal State Security mentioning the leak, and they will file the email away and do nothing." The two men watched the fireplace in the huge suite for a moment. Finally, Paul said, "I have an opportunity that I think will interest your government greatly. I would like to suggest an operation to you. If your agency agrees, I will only work with you, no one else." "Does it involve the United Kingdom?" "It involves the United States." "I'm sorry, Mr. Laska, but that is not my area of operations, and I am very busy here." "Yes, being assistant resident. But my proposal will make you resident in your pick of nations. What I am offering is that important." Valentin smiled, an affectation of amusement, but Laska could see a glint in the boy's eyes that reminded him of his father in his younger years. Valentin Kovalenko asked, "What is it you are proposing, Mr. Laska?" "Nothing less than the destruction of the American president, Jack Ryan." Valentin's head rose. "You've given up hope for your friend, Edward Kielty?" "Completely. Ryan will be elected, but I have hope that he will not set foot in the Oval Office to begin his second term." "That is a great hope you have there. Give me reason to share this hope." "I have a privately acquired file A dossier, if you will, of a man named John Clark. I am sure you know who he is. Valentin cocked his head, and Laska tried but could not read into the gesture. The Russian said, I might know that name. You are just like your father, not trusting. I am like most all Russians in that regard, Mr. Laska. Paul Laska nodded in recognition of the truth of the comment. In reply, he said, This exercise will not require your trust. John Clark is a close confidant of Jack Ryan. They have worked together, and they are friends. Okay, please continue. What does the file say? Clark was a CIA assassin. He did the bidding of Jack Ryan. Ryan signed a pardon for this. Do you know what a pardon is? I do. But I think Clark has done other things. Things that, if brought out into the light of day, will implicate Ryan directly. What things? You need to get your services file on Clark and put it with my file on Clark. If we had such a document already, that is to say, a file on this John Clark that had incriminating evidence, do you not think we would have exploited it by now? During the first Ryan presidency, perhaps? Laska waved away the comment. Very quickly and quietly, your service should re-interview anyone, anywhere, with knowledge of the man or his operations. Make one large dossier with every truth, half-truth, and innuendo. And then? And then I want you to give it to the Kielty campaign. Why? Because I cannot let it be known who my source of this information is. The file must come from someone else. Someone out of the USA. I want your people to dress it up with what you have to disguise the source. Innuendos do not convict men in your adopted country, Mr. Laska. They can destroy a political career. And more than that, it is what Clark is doing right now that must be revealed. I have reason to believe that he is operating for some extrajudicial organization, committing crimes around the world. And he would not be out committing these crimes if not for the full pardon given him by John Patrick Ryan. We get enough on Clark to Kielty. Kielty will force the Justice Department to investigate Clark. Kielty will do it for his own selfish reasons, no question. But it doesn't matter. What matters is that the investigation will find a house of horrors. Valentin Kovalenko looked into the fire. Paul Laska watched him. Watched the firelight flicker off of the lenses of his moss lipo glasses. This sounds like an easy operation from my side. A quick thumbing through of a dusty old file. A quick investigation using men from some third-party group as a cutout, not SVR or FSB. More cutouts to pass the results on to someone in Kielty's campaign. We will not be overexposed. But I do not know that there is much chance for success of the operation. I can't believe your country has any interest in a strong Ryan administration. Kovalenko had done little to tip his hand at any point in this conversation. But to Laska's last comment, he shook his head slowly, staring the older man in the eye. None whatsoever, Mr. Laska. But will there be enough to bring him down through Clark? In time to save Ed Kielty? No. Perhaps not even in time to prevent his inauguration. But Richard Nixon's Watergate took many months to germinate into something so big and bountiful that it resulted in his resignation. Very true. And what I know about the actions of John Clark makes the events of Watergate look like some sort of fraternity prank. Kovalenko nodded. A thin smile crossed his lips. Perhaps, Mr. Laska, I will take one small snifter of brandy as we chat further. 33. On a frigid October night in Makhachkala, Dagestan, 55 fighters of Jamaat Shariat met in a low-ceilinged basement with Suleyman Murshidov, the elderly spiritual leader of their organization. The men were aged between 17 and 47, and together they possessed hundreds of years of experience in urban warfare. These men had been hand-picked by operational commanders, and five of their number were cell leaders themselves. It had been explained to them that they would be sent to a foreign base for training, and then they would embark on an operation that would change the course of history. To a man, they thought their operation would involve a hostage situation, likely in Moscow, with their ultimate goal being the repatriation of their commander, Israpil Nabayev. They were only half right. None of these grizzled fighters knew the clean-shaven man with Murshidov and his sons. To them, he looked like a politician, not a rebel. So when Abu Dagestani explained that he would be their leader for their operation, they were stunned. Georgi Safronov spoke passionately to the 55 men in the basement. He explained that their ultimate goal would be revealed to them in due time. But for now, they would all be flying in a cargo plane to Quetta, Pakistan, from where they would venture northward to a camp. There, he explained, they would undergo 3 weeks of intense training by the best Muslim fighters in the world, men with more operational experience in the past decade than even their brothers in nearby Chechnya. All 55 men were pleased to learn this, but it was hard for them to look at Safronov as their leader. Suleyman Murshidov saw this, and he'd expected it. So he spoke again to the group, promised them all that Georgi was Dagestani, and his plan and his sacrifice would do more for the North Caucasus in the next 2 months than Jamaat Shariat could do without him in the next 50 years. After a final prayer, the 55 men loaded into minibuses and headed toward the airport. Georgi Safronov wanted to travel with them, but this was deemed too dangerous by General Ijaz, his Pakistani partner in this endeavor. No, Safronov would fly commercial to Peshawar, under documents made by Pakistani intelligence, and there he would be picked up by Ijaz and his men and flown directly to the camp near Miran Shah. At the camp, Georgi was expected to train with the other men. He would not be as skilled with a weapon, as physically fit, or as battle-hardened in his heart. But he would learn, he would strengthen, and he would toughen. He hoped he would earn the respect of the men who'd lived their adult lives resisting the Russians in and around Makhachkala. No, they would never look at him like they did Israfil Nabayev, but they would obey Abu Dagestani and follow Safronov's orders. And if he could learn the martial skills in Pakistan that would be necessary during their struggles ahead, Safronov thought that perhaps they would see him as a true commander, not just a sympathizer of their cause with a plan. Jack Ryan Jr. parked his yellow Hummer in front of Melanie Kraft's address a few minutes after 7. She lived on Princess Street in Alexandria, right up the road from the boyhood home of Robert E. Lee, near the former home of George and Martha Washington, on a portion of the street that was still paved with pre-Revolutionary War cobblestones. Ryan looked around at the beautiful old homes, surprised that a government employee in her mid-20s could afford to live here. He found her door and understood. Melanie lived at the address of a beautiful brick Georgian home, yes, but she lived in a carriage house in the back through the garden. They were still pretty nice digs, but he saw from the outside that her place was just larger than a one-car garage. She invited him in, and he confirmed that the apartment was indeed tiny, but she kept it neat. "I love your place," Melanie smiled.
"Thank you, I love it too. I'd never be able to afford it without help."
"Help?"
"An old professor of mine from AU is married to a real estate guy. They own the home. It was built in 1794. She rents the carriage house to me for about what I'd pay for a regular apartment around here. It's tiny, but it's all I need."
Jack glanced over at a card table in the corner. On top of it sat a MacBook Pro and a massive stack of books, notebooks, and loose printed pages. Some of the books, Ryan noticed, were printed in Arabic script. "Is that NCTC South?" he asked with a smile. She chuckled but quickly grabbed her coat and her purse and headed for the door.
"Shall we?"
Jack figured that was it for the grand tour, but other than the bathroom, he could see it all from where he stood anyway. He followed her out the door and into the cool evening. It was a 10-minute stroll to King Street, and they chatted about the old buildings as they walked. There were a lot of other people out, walking to and from dinner at this hour on a Saturday night. They stepped into the restaurant and were led to a romantic table for two overlooking the street. As they settled in with their menus, Jack asked, "Have you been here before?"
"Honestly, no. I hate to admit it, but I don't eat out much. 25-cent wing night at Murphy's is a big-time splurge for me."
"Nothing wrong with wings." Jack ordered a bottle of Pinot Noir, and they perused the menu while they chatted.
"So you were at Georgetown?"
Melanie said it as a statement. Ryan smiled. "Do you know that because Mary Pat told you, because you Googled me, or because you are in the CIA and you know everything?" She blushed slightly.
"I was at AU. I saw you a few times at things around town. You were a year ahead of me, I think. You were hard to miss with that big Secret Service guy around you all the time."
"Mike Brennan. He was a second dad to me. Great guy, but he scared off a lot of people. He's my excuse for having a boring social life in college."
"Good excuse. I'm sure being a celebrity has its drawbacks."
"I'm not a celebrity. Nobody recognizes me. My parents had money, but I sure as hell wasn't raised with a silver spoon in my mouth. I had a summer job through high school and college. I even worked construction for a while."
Melanie said, I was just talking about the trappings associated with being famous. I wasn't suggesting you don't deserve to be successful.
Sorry, said Jack.
I've had to defend myself more than once on that front.
I understand. You want to be accepted for your own talents, not for who your parents are.
You are very perceptive, Jack said.
I'm an analyst, she smiled. I analyze.
Maybe we should both analyze the menus before the waiter comes back.
Melanie's smile widened.
Uh-oh, somebody's trying to change the subject.
Damn right,
they both laughed now. The wine came, Jack tasted it, and the waiter poured for them both.
To Mary Pat.
To Mary Pat.
They clinked their wine glasses and smiled at each other.
So, Jack asked, tell me about CIA.
What do you want to know?
More than you can tell me.
He thought for a moment.
Have you spent any time overseas?
You mean with the agency?
Yes.
I have.
Where?
He caught himself. Sorry, you can't tell me where, can you?
Sorry, she said with a shrug. Jack saw that although she'd lived the life of an intelligence analyst for only a couple of years, she was comfortable with secrets.
Do you speak a foreign language?
Yes.
Jack started to ask her if that was classified too, but she filled him in.
Level 3 Masri, Egyptian Arabic, Level 2 French, Level 1 Spanish, nothing to write home about.
How many levels are there?
Sorry, Jack, I don't get out much. She laughed at herself. I don't have many conversations with people outside government service. It's called the ILR scale, Interagency Language Roundtable. There are 5 levels of proficiency. Level 3 means basically that I have normal rate of speech function in the language, but I make small mistakes that don't affect the comprehension of a listener native in the language I'm speaking.
And level 1?
It means I'm sloppy.
She laughed again.
What can I say? I learned Arabic living in Cairo and I learned Spanish in college. Nothing quite like needing to speak a language to get fed to promote the learning of it.
Cairo?
Yes. Dad was an Air Force attaché. We spent 5 years in Egypt when I was in high school and 2 more in Pakistan.
How was that?
I loved it. It was tough moving around as a kid, but I wouldn't trade it for the world. Plus, I learned Arabic, which has proven very helpful.
Jack nodded. I guess in your line of work it is.
He liked this girl. She did not put on airs at all. She neither tried to be overly sexy or a know-it-all. She was obviously highly intelligent, but she was self-deprecating about it at the same time. And she was very sexy, and it was all natural. He did notice more than once that she seemed to direct the focus of the conversation back on him.
So, she said with a playful smile, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess you don't live in a 400-square-foot carriage house subsidized by your ex-professor.
I've got an apartment in Columbia. It's near work, and near my parents in Baltimore. What about your family?
The waiter brought their salads, and Melanie began talking about the restaurant. Jack wondered if she just possessed one of those minds that had a tendency to branch off into different subjects during conversations, or if she was trying to avoid the subject of her family. He couldn't tell which it was, but he let it go. They meandered back to the subject of Jack's work. He explained his work at Henley Associates in the most boring general terms imaginable. Not entirely lies, but his explanation was rife with holes and secrets.
So, she asked, when your dad becomes president again, you will have a Secret Service detail following you around wherever you go.
Is that going to cause problems around your office?
You have no idea, Jack thought to himself. He smiled.
Nothing I'm not used to. I became great friends with guys on my detail.
Still, didn't it get stifling?
Jack wanted to put on a cool face, but he stopped himself. She was asking him an honest question. She deserved a straight answer.
Actually, yes, it was tough. I'm not looking forward to that. If my dad becomes president, I'll talk to him and my mom. I live a pretty low-profile life. I'm going to refuse protection.
Is that safe?
Yeah, sure. I'm not worried. He smiled over his wine glass. Don't they teach you CIA folks how to kill a man with a spoon?
Something like that.
Great. You can watch my back.
You couldn't afford me, she said with a laugh.
Dinner was excellent. The conversation was fun and it flowed, except for when Jack tried to probe Melanie once again about her family. She stayed as tight-lipped about her family as she did about CIA. They strolled home together after 10. The streets had thinned to foot traffic, and a cold wind blew in from the Potomac. Jack walked her up the drive toward the door of her tiny apartment.
I had fun, Melanie said.
Me too. Can we do it again soon?
Of course.
They got to the door.
Listen, Jack, I better get this out of the way. I don't kiss on the first date.
Ryan smiled. Neither do I. He extended a hand, which she took slowly, careful to keep the astonishment and embarrassment off her face. Have a great night. You'll be hearing from me.
I hope so.
Nigel Embling's house was in the center of Peshawar, not far from the massive and ancient Bala Hisar fort, which, with its 90-foot ramparted walls, commands the high ground of the city and lands around it. The city bustled with activity, but Embling's home was quiet and clean, an idyllic oasis of plants and flowers, the sound of tinkling fountains in the courtyard, and the smell of old books and furniture polish in the very British study on the second floor. Embling sat next to Driscoll at a wide table in his study. Across from them, 35-year-old Major Muhammad al-Darkur wore Western civilian clothing, a pair of brown slacks with a black button-down shirt. Al-Darkur had come alone to Embling's to meet a man he assumed was an officer in the CIA. He'd done his best to establish the bona fides of the man he had been introduced to as Sam, but Driscoll had deflected his questions about other CIA officers that al-Darkur had run into while working with the ISI. This worked to Driscoll's benefit. The CIA was, as far as al-Darkur was concerned, too supportive of elements in Pakistani intelligence, elements that al-Darkur knew were actively working against them. He found the CIA, and America by extension, to be naive and too ready to put its trust in those who paid lip service to the shared values between the two organizations. The fact that Sam appeared to be working outside the lines of American intelligence already entrenched in Pakistan, and the fact that Sam seemed to hold suspicions against al-Darkur himself, only increased the Pakistani major's opinion of the man. Embling said, "I've done my best to look into this Rian fellow. He's a bloody mystery." Sam agreed. "We are trying on our end as well. He's done a great job of covering his tracks in his career. It looks like he just materialized as a high-level PDF officer working for the ISI.
Not easy to do in the PDF. That lot loves their ceremony, always getting photographed and awarded this or that trinket for one thing or another. They learned pomp and circumstance from we English, and I can say with just a wee bit of pride that we show military off like no other."
"But no pictures of Rian?"
"A few, but years and years ago, when he was a young officer. Otherwise, he's a bloody shadow."
"But not anymore. What has changed?"
"That's what Muhammad and I are trying to find out."
Al-Darkur said, "The only reason I can think is that he's been groomed for something. Lieutenant General, head of the ISI, perhaps even head of the PDF someday. I believe he is working on a coup, but certainly he is too unknown to take the reins of government himself. He seems to have spent his entire career as a spy, which is not common for military officers. Most serving in ISI are just sent there for a few years. They are not professional spies, but professional soldiers. I myself was a commando with the 7th Battalion Special Services Group before coming to ISI. But Riaz Rian seems to be the exact opposite. He spent a few odd years as a lieutenant and captain in the regular PDF in the Azad Kashmir Regiment, but since then he seems to have had some role with inter-services intelligence, although they have kept that quite secret, even from the rest of the ISI.
"Is he a beard?" asked Driscoll, referring to an Islamist within their ranks.
"Only by association do I know that to be true. His benefactors at the head of the Army and Intelligence Services are most definitely Islamists, though Rian never turns up at any mosque, or on any list of attendees of the secret meetings the beards are always having. I've had prisoners of the hostile jihadist groups in my custody, and I've asked them, quite aggressively, I must admit, if they knew Rian from JIM. I am convinced none of them do."
Driscoll sighed. "So, what is the next step?"
Now al-Darkur brightened a little. "I have two pieces of information, one of which your people can help me with."
"Great."
"First, my sources have discovered that General Rian, in addition to his office at our headquarters in Islamabad, is also working out of a safe house in Dubai."
Driscoll cocked his head. "Dubai?"
"Yes. It is the financial hub of the Middle East, and his department most likely does banking for its foreign operations there. But that in itself would be no reason for him to work there. I think and his cadre of upper-level employees go there to plot against Pakistan itself."
"Interesting."
"In my position in the Joint Intelligence Bureau, I do not have the reach or assets to investigate him outside of our borders. I thought maybe your organization, with its near-infinite reach, might like to see what he is doing in Dubai."
"I'll pass it up the chain of command, but I am reasonably sure they will want to look into this safe house of his."
"Excellent."
"And the other piece of information?"
"This other avenue I will be able to look into with my own assets. There is an operation I have recently learned about that involves Rian's department and the Haqqani network. You are, I am certain, familiar with Haqqani?
Driscoll nodded. Jalaluddin Haqqani. His forces run large patches of the borderland of Pakistan and Afghanistan. He's tied with the Taliban, runs a network many thousands strong, and has killed hundreds of our soldiers in Afghanistan, as well as hundreds more locals in bombings, rocket and mortar attacks, kidnappings for ransom, etc., etc.
Al-Darqur nodded. Jalaluddin is an old man, so his son, Siraj, is leading the organization now. But otherwise, you have it right. I have a prisoner in custody, a courier in the Haqqani network who I captured in Peshawar after he met with an ISI lieutenant who is a known supporter of the Islamists. He has told my interrogators that the ISI is working with Haqqani network fighters at a camp of theirs near Miran Shah.
Working on what?
This courier does not know, but he does know they are expecting a foreign force there at the camp, and the ISI and Haqqani men will train these outsiders.
URC? Al-Qaeda?
He does not know. I, however, intend to find out who they are and what they are doing.
How will you do that?
I will go myself the day after tomorrow, and I will watch the road to the camp. We have a base in Miran Shah, of course, but Haqqani's people know about it. They lob in an occasional mortar shell, but otherwise they go on about their business. But we also have some safe houses around town, mostly to the south. Siraj Haqqani's forces know of some of them, so we do not use them anymore. But my agents have secured a location on the Boya Miran Shah Road, and this happens to be near where the prisoner says this training camp is located.
Great. When do we leave?
We, Sam? Asked Al-Darqur with raised eyebrows. Embling broke in.
Don't be daft, lad.
Sam shrugged.
I'd like to see this for myself. No offense. I'll tell my office about Dubai, but I'm here. Might as well come along with you if you'll have me.
It will not be safe. It is Miran Shah. There are no Americans there, I can promise you that. I will be heading down with a hand-picked crew of Zarar Special Service Commandos, men I trust implicitly. If you come, I can promise you that myself and my men will be in as much danger as you, so you will benefit from our desire for self-protection.
This made Driscoll smile. Works for me.
Embling didn't like it at all, but Sam had made up his mind. 20 minutes later, Driscoll sat on the cool rooftop veranda of Embling's house, drinking tea with one hand and holding a satellite phone with the other. The device, like all Henley Associates sat phones, was equipped with a chip that held an NSA Type 1 encryption package that made it secure. Only the person on the other end of the line would be able to hear Driscoll. Sam Granger answered on the other end.
Sam, it's Sam here.
What's the word?
The ISI contact seems solid. Not going to promise anything, but we may have a lead on Rian and his activities.
Driscoll told Granger about the Dubai safe house.
That is incredible if true.
Might be worth sending the guys over, Sam Driscoll suggested.
You don't want to go yourself? Asked Granger, somewhat surprised.
I'm going with the Major and a team of his SSG guys to North Waziristan for a little SR.
SR?
Strategic Reconnaissance.
In Haqqani territory?
Roger that, but I'll be with friendlies. Should be okay.
There was a pause in the connection.
Sam, you are the one whose neck is on the line, and I know you're not reckless, but still.
You will be in the belly of the beast, so to speak, will you not?
I will be as safe as the SSG men around me. They seem like they have their heads screwed on straight. Plus, we need to know what the ISI is up to at this camp. Any proof of Rihan or his people there is going to be critically important if we need to leak this guy to the intelligence community at a later date. I'm going to do my best to get pictures and shoot them back to you.
Granger said, I don't know if Henley will like this. Let's ask forgiveness instead of permission.
Like I said, it's your neck.
Roger that. I'll be in touch when I get back to Pesh. Don't stress if you don't hear from me for a while. It may be a week or two.
I understand.
Good luck.
The city of Miran Shah is the capital of North Waziristan, which lies within the federally administered tribal areas of western Pakistan, not far from the Afghan border. The area is not under the control of the Pakistani government in Islamabad, though there is a small and often harassed Pakistani defense force base here. The town and the region, including areas reaching far past the irrelevant Afghan border to the west, are under the control of the Haqqani network, a massive insurgent group that is closely allied with the Taliban. Jalaluddin Haqqani fought the Russians in Afghanistan in the 1980s and became a warlord of increasing power and scope. His sons followed in their father's footsteps, and they had a hand in virtually every aspect of life here in North Waziristan that was not snuffed out by American unmanned aerial vehicles that patrolled the sky above, waiting to be cleared hot for a missile launch.
their international reach, their dozens of covert insurgent camps, and their close ties with the Pakistani intelligence service made the Haqqani family a natural partner of Riaz Rian throughout the years. He had used their territory and facilities to train fighters and operatives for missions in India and Afghanistan, and he had reached out to them again recently, asking for their assistance in training a large cell of foreign fighters for a mission. The Haqqani leadership accepted the request of Joint Intelligence Miscellaneous to send the men, and Rihan himself came along to oversee the initial phases of the training. Though he had no military or insurgent training whatsoever, Russian rocket entrepreneur Georgi Safronov was the leader of the unit of Jamaat Shariat forces who arrived at the Haqqani camp near Boya, west of Miran Shah, in the third week of October. With him was the man he knew as General Ijaz, as well as his unit of 55 Dagestani rebels. The huge force of foreigners was outfitted by the Haqqani forces and billeted in a large cave complex dug into the walls of a hillside. Much of the training itself took place inside the man-made caves and under corrugated tin roofs painted to look like dirt and farmland so as not to attract the attention of U.S. drones. But some team tactics training did take place in fields and on hillsides. The UAVs were not invisible. Specially trained spotters were posted to keep an eye out for America's eyes in the sky. But the UAVs were stealthy enough that Rian himself ordered the Haqqani network to place absolute priority not on the quality of the training of the foreigners, but on maintaining the security of the operation. Rian did not really care if the Dagestani insurgents had the talents necessary to take over and hold a space launch facility in Kazakhstan. No, he was instead interested only in their ability to succeed in a mission here in Pakistan that they would need to undertake to gain control of the two nuclear weapons. If they lost half their number while executing this mission, it was of no great concern to Rian. His only concern was that the world learned that nuclear bombs had been stolen out from under the Pakistanis' noses by foreign terrorists. He felt certain that this would lead to the disintegration of the Pakistani government within days or weeks. The Haqqani network took Rian's order to ramp up security seriously. They sent spies into the villages and neighborhoods between Miran Shah and Boya, keeping an eye out for anyone interested in the movement of men and material. Little happened in North Waziristan without Haqqani knowing about it. But now there was virtually nothing that could avoid detection by the powerful force. The Pashtun fighters found the Dagestani fighters to be quite good with their weapons and extremely motivated individuals. But they lacked unit cohesion, and this was something that Haqqani's people had developed by necessity in the decade they had been fighting coalition forces over the border. The only member of the unit who did not know how to handle a gun or handle himself in any physical sense was their leader. Safronov had adopted the nom de guerre, Magomed Dagestani, Mohammed the Dagestani. But although he now possessed a name that conveyed his intent, he lacked any martial abilities to back it up. But he was smart and motivated to learn. So slowly, the Taliban in the cave complex taught him how to use handguns and rifles and grenade launchers and knives. And by the end of the first week, he had come a long way. Rian was in and out of the camp, splitting time between his home in Dubai, his office in Islamabad, and the cave complex. All the while, Rian encouraged the Dagestanis to stay motivated for the hard work ahead, and Safronov to stay strong and committed to the action. 34. The third and final presidential debate was held in Los Angeles, at the Edwin W. Pauley Pavilion on the campus of UCLA. It was a more formal affair than the last encounter. This time the two men would be at lecterns in front of a panel of questioners, reporters from the big media outlets as well as one of the wire services. It was an open forum. There was no particular theme to the event, with the idea that the biggest issues in the last 3 weeks of the campaign would naturally be discussed. In theory, this would lead to a few topics that would get passionate attention from the candidates, but in actuality, other than a few questions on economic bailouts of foreign nations, China's massive increase of military expenditures, and rising gas prices, one topic was at the forefront. The president's decision to try Saif Yassin in the federal system got the lion's share of attention, as well as candidate Jack Ryan's vocal opposition to this. With the subject of the emir naturally came the subject of Pakistan. The Islamabad government had spent the past decade taking billions of dollars annually from the United States while simultaneously working at cross purposes with American military and intelligence efforts, and the safe haven that Western Pakistan had become
had given much aid and comfort to the organizations that committed terrorist atrocities around the world. Kilty's plan to influence Pakistan to rehabilitate and provide real support for U.S. interests was, essentially, to double down. While he threatened to cut off aid to Islamabad unless the situation improved, covert funding and support for the ISI and PDF actually increased as the White House tried to buy off commanders and departments that held influence over strategy. Ryan's plan, like most of his ideas when compared to Kielty's, stood in stark contrast. When asked by the AP reporter on the panel what he would do to the funding levels of the Pakistani intelligence and military services, he replied succinctly,
"Cut it. Cut it and use some of that money to support our great friend and ally in the region, India."
He'd been saying this on the campaign trail for some time, and he'd been taking a beating for it in the media. The American press spun his support for India over Pakistan as stirring up an old conflict by putting U.S. strength behind one power over another, despite Ryan's retort that Pakistan supports terrorism against the United States while India does not.
"Of course we want to put our strength behind our friends and pull support from our enemies. Pakistan does not have to be our enemy," he said into the cameras at the Pauley Pavilion. "But that has been their choice. When I return to Washington, I will turn off that spigot of support until Islamabad shows us that they can control their urges and combat Islamic terrorism in India and the West."
The CBS Washington correspondent was next, and she asked Ryan how he could possibly punish the entire nation of Pakistan for the actions of a few rogue agents in the ISI. Ryan nodded slowly before replying.
"The ISI does not have rogue agents. It is a rogue agency. My opponent says individual men or individual units are the problem. I disagree. The rogue elements of the ISI, frankly, are the ones who are on our side. The ISI and the army are our enemy, save for a limited number of men, a limited number of units, who are our friends. We need to find these rogues and do what we can to support them in ways other than just sending billions of dollars unchecked into the coffers of the Pakistani government. That is a welfare check for the supporters of terror, and that, ladies and gentlemen, is a decade-long strategy that has not produced the desired results."
Kielty's rebuttal was short.
"President Ryan supported Pakistan to the tune of several billion dollars when he was president."
To which Jack, speaking out of turn but speaking nonetheless, said,
"And I was wrong about that. We all were. And I hate to admit it, but I will not stick with a failed policy just to hide the fact I made a mistake."
The journalists on the panel sat and stared at Ryan. A presidential candidate admitting a mistake was alien to them. The next questioner was from CNN, and she asked both candidates about the trial of the emir. Kielty repeated his support for the process, and he challenged Ryan to tell him why, exactly, he felt the Department of Justice would not be able to aggressively prosecute Mr. Yassin. Ryan looked into the camera with raised eyebrows.
"President Kielty, I accept your challenge. We have brought several terrorists to trial in the federal system over the past 20 years. Some of those prosecutions were more successful than others. Many of the cases in which the Attorney General failed to get a conviction involved defendants who were represented by a powerful legal team who, in the opinion of many legal scholars, bent the rules in the defense of their clients. Now, the American system of justice could not survive without a vigorous defense, but many of these defense attorneys crossed the line. This happened on my watch, so I was very close to the work of my AG, and I saw what these defense attorneys did, and I was sickened by it. The emir will not have many of these defense attorneys, and you may think that is a good thing, ladies and gentlemen, but it is not. Because 9 of these attorneys who advocated for the terrorists who killed thousands of Americans at home and on the battlefields are now working for the Justice Department. If these people, all unabashed advocates of the terrorists, are part of the government's prosecution, and the terrorists' own lawyers are unabashed advocates of the terrorists, who is there to be an advocate of the American people?
Kielty's nostrils flared on rebuttal.
Well, Mr. Ryan, you keep calling these defendants terrorists. They are alleged terrorists until they are convicted. I don't know if any of these men are guilty, and neither do you.
Ryan replied, again turning the moderated debate into an unmoderated conversation.
One of the men who was defended by people who are now representing the United States in the Justice Department's case against the emir said from the witness box, he screamed it actually, and this was the quote from the trial transcript, I hope the jihad will continue and strike the heart of America and all kinds of weapons of mass destruction will be used. Can we not take this man at his word that he is an enemy of our nation, a terrorist?
Keelty waved it away and replied. The moderator had lost all control.
You aren't a lawyer, Jack. Sometimes people say things that are intemperate. That does not make them guilty of the crime for which they are being tried. Intemperate? Screaming that you hope America is destroyed is intemperate, Mr. President?
That's right, you are a lawyer.
The crowd laughed. Jack put his hand up quickly.
Nothing against attorneys. Some of my best friends are lawyers, but even they tell the most biting lawyer jokes.
More laughs. Ryan continued.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, you will be forgiven for not knowing about this terrorist, his outburst, and the fact that 9 of his defense attorneys now work in the Keelty administration. You will be forgiven because there was very little mention of this in the media at the time. But it troubles me, Mr. President, that 9 members of your administration worked on the defense of terrorists. Now they are in positions of influence in our government, where they bring the same warped sensibilities to their jobs, which ultimately is the national security of the United States. And then, when the military commissions are suggested, you and your people say these defendants can only get a fair trial in federal court. I think most Americans will be bothered by this.
He looked to the panel of journalists sitting before him.
If they only knew about it.
Jack also wanted to wink at Arnie Van Dam, who, right now, would be reaching for the Maalocs. Arnie had told Jack over and over not to antagonize the press, because it didn't look presidential.
Screw how it looks, Jack decided. They have it coming. President Keelty's attorney general made the comment recently, again, it wasn't reported by the mainstream press for some reason, that the FBI put Capone in prison for tax evasion, and maybe we should look into similar means to prosecute the terrorist we captured on the battlefield, because their capture was clearly not in the rule of law. Do you agree with this, President Keelty? Do you or your Justice Department know how many captured terrorists filed U.S. income tax forms last year?
Keelty did his best to control his rage, but his face reddened under his makeup. He replied,
My opponent believes there is one type of justice for us and another type of justice for them. If by them you are saying Al-Qaeda or the Umayyad Revolutionary Council or any one of a number of groups that mean to destroy us, then yes, that is what I believe. They deserve their day in court, a chance to defend themselves, but they do not deserve each and every right afforded the citizens of the United States.
Mohammed Al-Darkour, Sam Driscoll, 3 ISI captains, and a dozen Zarar commandos flew out of PAF base Peshawar at 4 a.m. in a Pakistani Air Force Y-12 turboprop transport aircraft. The pilot took them to the southeast, over the mountains of Khyber and Quran agencies, and finally into North Waziristan. They landed on Miran Shah's one useful runway and were immediately shuffled by local forces into an armored personnel carrier for the ride through the dark town to the military fort. Within seconds of entering the main gate of the base, Al-Darkour, Driscoll, the 3 captains, and 2 sections of soldiers piled into 4 heavy-duty delivery trucks with canvas-covered beds, and they rolled straight out of the rear gate of the compound. If any Haqqani network spies were watching the comings and goings of the PDF forces in town, this would throw them off the scent. There would be spies near the fort, and the ISI had developed certain countermeasures to lose any surveillance they picked up before heading out to one of their safe houses. The 4 delivery trucks rolled back through town at dawn, past the airport to the west, and separated onto different roads. Each truck pulled into a different small walled compound in a different part of the city, and the men inside the vehicles climbed out and then climbed aboard new trucks. Spotters on the roofs of the compounds watched to see if their visitors had picked up any tails and, when they deemed the streets clear of Haqqani watchers, radioed down and all clear to the new trucks. The gates were reopened by men stationed in advance at the safe house, and the new, cleansed trucks departed. The 4 vehicles drove individually through the early morning traffic toward the south, and then each vehicle, spaced 5 minutes or so apart, headed out of Miran Shah. Driscoll found himself in the back of the 3rd truck. He'd been cloaked with a shawl to cover his western features, but he peeked out of it and saw armed men walking the streets, riding on motorcycles, and peering out of walled buildings. These were exclusively Haqqani's fighters. There were thousands, and even though the PDF had a tiny outpost here and the ISI maintained a few safe houses, Miran Shah was Haqqani's town. As they drove farther south, leaving the town and entering cultivated fields, Sam thought he could hear automatic weapons fire behind him. He motioned to one of the soldiers in the truck with him, trying to find out if the man knew of the source of the fire.